ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 9th of March. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. Iran is close to naming a new supreme leader after another day of intense Israeli and US bombing of the country, which has blanketed the capital Tehran in a thick black smoke. Iran has also continued to fire back at Israel and the Gulf states, with a missile hitting near Tel Aviv overnight. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran is in Jerusalem for us this morning. Matt, take me through the latest developments in Iran.
Mel, good morning. Let's start with those strikes on Iranian oil facilities, which have triggered almost apocalyptic scenes across the country. There were fireballs lighting up the night sky, particularly in the capital, Tehran, after an attack on the Shahran refinery there. That wasn't the only fuel site hit, according to local media, but certainly it has got a lot of attention considering the vision that was emerging from that site. And those fires are still burning. They've been blanketing places like Tehran, a city of 10 million people in thick, acrid smoke all day. It's prompting a warning from the Iranian Red Crescent for people to stay indoors with their windows closed, to use face masks as well. And there is reportedly acidic rain also being reported in some parts of the country, particularly in Tehran there. Now, Israeli officials say that they were hit, these fuel depots were hit, because they are part of the Iranian war machine, and that, they argue, makes them lawful targets. It's also coming at the same time that the Assembly of Experts, the group of clerics who make key decisions about the future of Iran, have been meeting to pick a new leader. It looks as though they have picked a new leader. They just haven't actually announced the name of the successor for the slain Ali Khamenei, although it does look like his son, Mohtaba Khamenei, will be the likely successor. He is already being met with threats from Israel, with Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, saying whoever takes on that role will be targeted as well.
And Matt, what about Iran's retaliatory strikes across the region?
Well, we have seen over the last 24 hours or so wave after wave of these attacks from Iran. In Israel, sirens have been ringing out all through the day, with around a dozen or so barrages coming in this direction. One of those missiles did make it through the country's air defences and hit an area in Tel Aviv. The incident caught on camera there, throwing debris into the air and damaging buildings on a residential street. Other sites have also been hit by shrapnel from missiles which have been blown out of the sky by interceptors. Missiles fired by Israel. We also know that Iran has continued striking closer to home as well. Saudi Arabia has announced that two people were killed and a dozen injured when there was an attack which hit near a residential area there. The Gulf states also being targeted. The UAE now effectively saying it's on a war footing after being targeted by 1,400 missiles and drones since the conflict began last Saturday. Now, Israeli media has been reporting that the UAE launched a strike of its own on an Iranian desalination plant. That could be another escalation, the first time the UAE has attacked Iran, but the Emiratis are rejecting those reports. They're saying they'll announce what they're doing when they do them, and they're suggesting that some Israeli media are being briefed wrongly by Israeli officials who are spreading claims and rumours about them. So it is a significant situation still causing a lot of chaos across that region. And while all of that is happening, on another front to the north of Israel, Israel continues to attack Lebanon too. The death toll there climbing towards 400.
Matthew Doran there. And just before Matthew spoke to us, he was talking to people in Beirut about that latest volley of strikes from the Israeli military.
Half a dozen floors up from a busy Beirut street, a hole has been punched in the facade of the Ramada Hotel. The precision of the strike leaving most of the building untouched, but finding its target. Israel said it was going after members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard hiding out in the hotel. Local health authorities say at least four people were killed and 10 injured.
We were asleep when we heard a very loud strike.
Jubai is staying at another hotel across the road, having fled his home in southern Lebanon.
I knew it was a missile. I recognised the sound. I immediately thought, that's a strike. It was very loud in the night. We were shocked and went down to the street.
It's the first strike by Israel in downtown Beirut, outside of Hezbollah's southern suburb stronghold of Dahiyeh, since Lebanon was dragged into the broader war last week when the Iranian-backed militant group launched rockets south towards Israel. Since then, Israel has demanded the evacuation of everyone south of the Litani River and launched a ground invasion, with troops and tanks pouring over the border. In the village of Masna, tens of thousands of Syrians who'd been living in Lebanon are fleeing the country. Some of the cars lining up at the border checkpoint crammed full of their belongings as they race to relative safety. For others, just getting out was the priority.
The strike happened at night. We fled in the night with nothing. There were five of us, my mother, my father, and the rest of us. And we left, just like that.
Among those leaving is Raja El Dahash.
If the situation had been normal, we wouldn't have left. But given the circumstances, we had to save our lives. We don't have a house, nothing at all. We're going without knowing where we'll stay. No camp, nothing. We don't know how we'll manage.
Mustafa, a mechanic, is also queuing to leave.
I'm going to Syria to find work. I hope there is work. If not, I'll see what I can do. When the situation stabilizes in Lebanon, I will come back.
Escaping to uncertainty, better than the danger left behind. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
The situation in Iran has deteriorated significantly in the past 48 hours, and widespread internet blackouts are hampering the ability of Iranians to contact the outside world. But Iranian journalists living in exile in London are continuing to broadcast news into the country from afar. The death of Ayatollah Khamenei has brought them relief and also hope that their lives and that of their families will be safer. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss filed this report.
Living in exile for their own safety, these Iranian journalists beam news back to their people still living inside Tehran's repressive regime. Fariba Shirazi was the one who broke the news of the US-Israeli strikes to her viewers.
I was shocked, full of emotion. It was not just the announce a normal news, it's just the announce a ending of the period of the very, very dark history of Iran.
In 2017, Iran International established its first newsroom in London, employing journalists who'd fled Iran. It's now broadcasting from 22 bureaus across 16 countries, employing around 900 reporters. Executive news editor Ali Ashkar Ramenzampour compares the death of Iran's supreme leader to the fall of the Soviet Union.
I can say that was the dream of my life. After years and years dealing with the stories about Khamenei and about what he did, for the first time I could think about the justice.
The death of Ayatollah Khamenei has reduced the risk faced by journalists here, but it by no means removes it. Barak Sina is a strategic intelligence expert and senior associate fellow at the Henry Jackson Society.
As the regime is on its last legs, it will lash out because they'll feel that they have nothing to lose. It's not going to be a rational calculation.
As these journalists continue to report on this widening war, many, including Fariba, have no idea if their loved ones are safe.
I haven't heard from my sisters or my mom, and I'm so concerned about that. But we have hope.
For those in exile, Iran isn't yet an option, but they're hoping if the regime falls, they might finally be able to return home. This is Catherine Diss in London, reporting for AM.
The Australian government is considering a request for military assistance from the Gulf states, which continue to be targeted by Iran as the war in the Middle East enters its second week. Minister for Foreign Affairs Penny Wong has given assurances the government will be transparent with the public if a decision is made, but questions remain as to what military capability Australia could offer the Gulf states. Political reporter Lexi Junawick has more.
Another drone. The high-pitched whirr of an Iranian drone rings out in Dubai, hitting its target, the international airport, over the weekend. as a call for military support from the Gulf nations is considered by the Australian government.
We have been asked for assistance and we will work through that.
Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong won't say what kind of military assistance has been requested, other than that it would be to protect the Gulf states from Iranian drone and missile strikes, which have continued despite an earlier apology from Iran's president for attacks on neighbouring countries.
We are not participating in offensive action against Iran. We've made clear we would not participate in any ground troop deployment into Iran.
What is unclear is which of the six Gulf states the plea has come from, but both the Foreign Affairs Minister and Prime Minister have spoken with the United Arab Emirates' Foreign Minister and President, respectively, in the past week to acknowledge the nation's assistance to stranded Aussies amid the war. Around 115,000 Australian citizens remain in the Middle East.
There's been a lot of people register. We're working through that. And to date, we have about 11,000 that we have assessed as eligible and seeking to leave. And we've opened the portal to more countries in the region, including Lebanon.
In a statement, Shadow Defence Minister James Patterson says he's sought a briefing from the government about the potential deployment of Defence Force personnel to the Middle East in defensive roles. So, if Australia is to accept, what could military support from the ADF look like? David Andrews is a senior policy advisor with the Australian National University National Security College.
It could be more in a sort of in logistics and in sort of background support or sensing support. It could be sort of other platforms that we have that could assist in improving the regional sensor environment to detect incoming projectiles, for example. There could be all sorts of different things.
Mr. Andrews says there's a case for Australia to provide assistance, especially given our fuel security is reliant on the flow of oil and gas through the Gulf.
But I think there would be caution to ensure that we don't get too caught up into what is at the moment seeming like a fairly open-ended conflict.
As the war in the Middle East continues with no clear endpoint, the Greens have accused the government of participating in so-called mission creep. Dr. Malcolm Davis, senior analyst in defence strategy at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, doesn't agree that's the case.
I don't see mission creep here. I see a sensible approach by the government. They're not rushing in to deploy military forces into harm's way or to go into combat. What we are doing is a very careful and sensible and considered approach.
Dr. Malcolm Davis there from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, ending that report from Lexi Junawick. The Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs is Ted O'Brien, and he joins us this morning. Ted, thank you for joining me on AM.
Thank you, Mel.
Now, in your view, should Australia support Gulf countries defend themselves against Iran's attacks?
We certainly have a very proud history as a country in working closely with our allies and partners, especially at times of crisis. I listened very keenly to the Foreign Minister's explanation on Insiders yesterday. We have sought a briefing from the government and will consider what sort of deployment of assets or resources they are considering. And we'll be making that consideration, of course, in the national interest.
So certainly the coalition is open to the prospect.
We are. As far as I'm concerned, the United States and Israel have been doing the heavy lifting for the free world here. We have supported in a bipartisan fashion their strikes on Iran. Now that we see other countries in the Gulf under attack and a request has been made of the Australian government, then we'll await the briefing. But we'll be considering things in our national interest. And I believe, given the United States and Israel have been doing the heavy lifting in everyone's national interest, anyone who believes in the free world, in freedom, I believe they have been doing the work. So we'll see what the government has to say. If it's in our national interest, I believe they'll have bipartisan support.
Do you think the Australian government should be more focused on its resources and efforts in the Indo-Pacific region rather than the Middle East, where, supportive as we might be of the UAE, they're not a formal ally of our country?
Well, there's no doubt that our primary focus should always be on our own backyard, in particular the Indo-Pacific. However, there is conflict going on right now in the Middle East. And this is where we're talking about a very rogue regime which has perpetrated Australia. It has sought to undertake terror attacks on our soil and far worse attacks on some of our friends and allies. We support what the United States and Israel is doing, and therefore, if support is requested, as as it has been, it should be duly considered.
In your view, if Australia does help with these defensive efforts, would that make Australia a participant in the conflict?
Well, of course, if we are participating, I hear what Penny Wong, Foreign Minister, said, it would be in a defensive capacity. If we were to participate in a defensive capacity, of course, we'd be participating in that capacity.
Yep. When it comes to Australians stranded in the Gulf states, more than 1,500 have been able to fly home so far on commercial flights. There have been some buses taking Australians from Dubai to Riyadh to get out through Saudi Arabia. Is that a successful repatriation effort?
I'm glad to see that things are now finally happening, Mel. Notwithstanding the coalition's bipartisan support for the Labor government, I have been critical that the government has been flat-footed on their communication in the lead-up to the strikes, but also post the strikes happening with 115,000 Australians in the Gulf, many of whom are stranded, many of whom want to come home.
Is it beyond the communications that you have issues with? I mean, have there been failings beyond that in your view?
Well, certainly what we're hearing from people on the ground in the Middle East is they have lost confidence in the communications coming from the Australian government. I've heard stories about Aussies in hotels seeing other foreigners being put on buses to go elsewhere for flights out of the country to be evacuated, yet they have not heard the plan from the Australian government. By the sounds of it, the last 24, 48 hours, things have picked up. That is a good thing. Given the lack of engagement on the conflict side, the primary goal of this government has got to be to keep Australians safe and to bring them home where they wish to come home.
Do you think realistically anyone could have come home sooner than they have, given the restrictions on airspace and the limitation of flights, be they commercial or military, to be able to leave the area?
What we do know is other countries were taking far stronger action, whether that be the UK, the US, Germany, France, even New Zealand, to try to evacuate their people sooner. That's what we know.
Here in Australia, the Iranian women's soccer team has been playing in the Asian Cup. They've come under pretty intense political pressure to support the ruling regime at home and show their fealty. Do you think they should be granted political asylum in Australia if they request it?
Mel, the bravery of these women is quite something. For them to undertake what really was a silent protest against a regime, a murderous regime that you have in Iran, is something I think every Australian should admire. We are, of course, in contact with the government on this matter. We want people to have freedom. We want to ensure that women are treated elsewhere in the world like they are in Australia. I am not aware that asylum has been requested at this point. If asylum is requested, I have confidence that the government will give it due consideration. This is a diabolical situation.
Is there more that Australia could do to support this team in particular?
Well, I mean, they have just finished their last game, I believe, last night. And so it's early in the day yet. Let's wait and see. But we are in contact with the government. I'm hesitant to go any further. There are sensitivities here, of course, the well-being and safety of not just these women, but their families back in there in Iran is key. So I will restrict my comments to what I've already said.
And on another matter, The Australian is reporting this morning that the coalition's considering a policy that would require temporary visa holders to make an appeal if they've been refused a visa from their country of origin, not here in Australia. Is that an idea you support?
I don't want to preempt where the coalition might go on its immigration policy. As Angus Taylor has made it very clear, we have some key objectives here. We need to have higher standards, we need to have lower numbers, and we need to shut the door on people coming in who do not share Australian values. They're the basic principles upon which a policy is being formulated, but I don't want to preempt any particular aspect that may or may not be included in that policy.
But evidently the backlog of appeal cases in Australia and the volume of those cases is something the coalition is looking at?
I absolutely agree that that is a problem which needs to be solved, but I won't be preempting the solution that the coalition will land on.
All right. Ted O'Brien, thank you very
thank
much
you
for
very
speaking
much,
to me this
appreciate
morning.
It.
Ted O'Brien is the Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Can you believe work on a high-speed rail network could start in just 2 years' time? No? Well, that's not surprising because we've been talking about fast train travel for decades. Today, Joe Langley, an urban planner, on why it really could happen this time. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.